supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. 12 suburban families are paying tuition to attend selective Philadelphia public schools. And members of City Council are not happy about the arrangement. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron reports.
District officials say they don't know how long the practice has been going on, but they acknowledge 12 students from outside the city are paying for slots at special admission schools. That revelation came during the school district's budget hearing before City Council. Cindy Bass was among several council members who urged the district to preserve all seats for Philly residents.
I think every member of council gets the calls where you have a parent who is frantically trying to get their child into a higher performing school and in the hopes of being able to get their child admitted to one of these special admit schools. And the idea that those spaces aren't available to them because they have somehow made their way to someone else. I really think that needs much further explanation.
The budget hearing is an annual opportunity for council members to grill district officials. It can be tense, especially when the district needs more money. That wasn't the case this year, but there was still plenty to discuss. Council members asked the district to add more librarians and music teachers, and Councilwoman Helen Gimm pressed the district to resolve its four-year contract dispute with the city's teachers union.
We've got a huge number of heroic educators in our city who are working in under-resourced and already understaffed schools, and they've been pushed to the limit.
In an online survey conducted by the union, more than half of the 1,000 teachers who responded say they're looking for work outside the district. Superintendent William Height says he and union leaders are in active negotiations. Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
On Tuesday, Pennsylvania voters will select from a dizzying array of judicial candidates vying for seats on state and local courts. To help make an informed primary election day decision, 52 candidates for 17 open seats were scrutinized by the Philadelphia Bar Association's Campaign for Qualified Judges. Joining me with more is Deborah Gross, Chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association. Debbie, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
What are the criteria by which the association made their recommendations?
So each candidate who runs for an office has a questionnaire that they fill out. It gives information about their background, when they graduated from law school, lists cases that they've been involved with, gives the judicial commission individuals who were opposing them, judges before whom they argued or practiced, as well as individuals for references.
But what is a voter supposed to do with that information?
The voter doesn't do anything with that information. The commission does a lot of work with that information. The commission itself interviews over 20 references, people who are not references from the candidate, but they go out and do searches on their own. The commission actually interviews the candidate, asks questions, and then the commission makes a recommendation as to whether this candidate is recommended or not recommended. The decision as to whether the candidate is recommended or not recommended is based on the individual's legal ability, you know, to how they've earned the respect of lawyers and judges, that they've had trial or other experience, that they have a record and reputation for excellent character and integrity. There are a number of criteria. There are over 10 different criteria that the commission evaluate.
So, for example, the Pennsylvania Superior Court, there are 10 candidates running. By what criteria did you make your recommendations?
So the criteria, the same criteria that we used for analysis and of the Court of Common Pleas. The other important focus with respect to the appellate court candidates is that they have offices in Philadelphia. So that there are candidates who in all likely are qualified, but we don't evaluate them because their offices are not in Philadelphia.
Ultimately, why is it important in the minds of you and the Bar Association that a voter vote for someone from the list who's recommended or highly recommended versus one who's not?
Because that person has the qualifications which the bar is comfortable with. That person has the ability, has the integrity, has the, you know, financial stability that the bar believes is necessary for that person to be an excellent and fair judge.
So, Debbie, here in Pennsylvania, 2017, what are some of the obvious cohorts or demographics that could be affected by this specific election?
And so this election is important because there are various topics that particularly affect Philadelphia, you know, one of which is immigration. As we all know, it is not a warm and welcoming environment to immigrants. And so we have to make sure that their rights are protected. We, as a bar association, have been trying to hold these convenings. We're calling them Take Action Philadelphia to educate lawyers, because lawyers have been rising to help out when there are situations. There's a bunch of lawyers went down to the airport to help the immigrants and when they were prevented from deplaning. It's just very important to us to help out with immigration, to make sure that there's a fair and just process, that people are given due process. We're also focused on the Medicaid situation that is probably will be arising in the very near future. Philadelphia has the largest population of seniors out of the 10 largest cities in the United States, and Medicaid will directly impact seniors. The Medicaid reductions will directly impact seniors, the young, those with disabilities. We're trying to also bring awareness to the public about these issues. We've had some convening in February on immigration. We will have a convening in January on Medicaid to make sure that people are aware. And it's part of educating the electorate.
There are always tensions between Harrisburg and Philadelphia. Is that playing out in a particular way this cycle?
That is too, because Harrisburg is also trying to cut funding for particular areas of which Philadelphia is the largest recipient of funding. So, you know, with respect to immigration, and while we call it a Fourth Amendment city, it is also called a sanctuary city. And there's a bill in Harrisburg to cut funding to cities that provide sanctuary. There's also a proposal in Harrisburg with respect to cutting Medicaid funding. So the legislature in Harrisburg is parroting the general environment right now in the United States.
Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Deborah Gross, Chancellor of the Philadelphia Bar Association. For more information, you can visit philadelphiabar.org. Staying on the topic of Pennsylvania's May 15th primary, let's head next to the Lehigh Valley. In Allentown, questions remain about the mayor's involvement in an ongoing federal investigation, though that hasn't stopped Ed Pawlowski from seeking a fourth term. And despite the threat of an indictment, he just might win it. More now from Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff.
On a recent sunny afternoon, Hamilton Street in downtown Allentown is bustling. Restaurants and shops are crowded, city work crews are planting flowers, and everyone has to talk a little louder over the din of construction. There are luxury apartments and mixed-use developments going up in and around this state-backed Neighborhood Improvement Zone, or the NIZ. Josh Tucker owns a furniture store nearby.
It has improved tremendously, especially since the NIZ zone was created. The hockey arena and everything that has come with it has been absolutely terrific.
Tucker sees Mayor Ed Pawlowski as the driving force behind this development.
As mayor, I think he has a tremendous amount to do with that.
But that's not enough for some residents, like Cheryl Redmond. Redmond says she's not planning to vote in the May 16th primary. But if she did, Pawlowski wouldn't get her support.
With everything that's going on, the FBI involved and everything else, he needs to get out, and we need a new mayor.
Almost 2 years ago, the FBI raided Allentown City Hall, claiming a figure identified as public official number 3 exchanged city contracts for campaign donations. Since then, 7 people associated with the city government have pled guilty on pay-to-play charges, and they've all pointed to public official number 3 as the ringleader. It's widely accepted that Pawlowski is the only person in Allentown who fits the FBI's description of public official number 3, but that hasn't stopped the mayor from running for re-election. At a debate between the candidates recorded by the Allentown Morning Call, Pawlowski pushed back against allegations that there was a cloud of suspicion over his administration.
I think the city's actually moving in a pretty good direction. We're growing, we're getting new jobs, we're getting new development. I don't see any cloud that has stopped the city from progressing.
I think I described it as chutzpah for him to choose to do that in the face of all that's going on.
Bill White is a columnist at the Allentown Morning Call. He's repeatedly urged the mayor to step down, but says despite the FBI investigation, Pawlowski may actually get reelected.
There are people in the city who are real grateful for his leadership in different areas that were important to them over time, and I think you know, I expect that they will vote for him.
According to a Muhlenberg College morning call survey, 54% of Allentown residents think Pawlowski has had a positive effect on the city. They're fairly evenly split on whether he deserves another term, but that may be enough. He's running against five other Democrats. And though Pawlowski's lawyer has said they're expecting an indictment, residents are divided on whether he'll actually be charged. That concerns White.
People still don't know if he's going to be charged with anything. So, you know, 2 weeks after the election, he's nominated by the Democrats, and now we indict him for corruption. And now where are we?
Voters might not get an answer before the primary election, according to Peter Vira, an attorney and former federal prosecutor in Philadelphia. He says the feds are supposed to stay neutral by bringing charges when they're ready, regardless of an upcoming election.
Technically, it's supposed to be irrelevant, but we have to look at the fact that the prosecutor has common sense and said, look, I'm 1 week away, 2 weeks away from an election or a primary. I'm not going to add that to the mix.
After the controversial role of the FBI in the 2016 presidential election, Vira says prosecutors are likely to proceed with caution. But if Pawlowski ends up winning the nomination, there's still a chance an indictment could come before the general election. Even if he is indicted and it goes to trial, Pawlowski could stay in office until a verdict is delivered. Columnist Bill White says that's a very real possibility.
We could be talking at Christmas time next year about Mayor-elect Pawlowski, you know, for his fourth term and, you know, facing trial.
White says voters in the upcoming primary election have a chance to end this saga. But he's been around long enough to know it might not go away that easily. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY serves as the lead station. 2 weeks ago, federal immigration agents took 12 people into custody at a mushroom farm in southern Chester County. Advocates for immigrants have decried the arrests as unlawful, but it's just the beginning for the men now behind bars. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports at least one of the workers has left the country rather than waiting in prison for a decision in his case.
Lawyers say none of those arrested has a criminal record, but having a prior deportation can act like an express ticket out of the country. Caitlin Berry runs the Farm Worker Legal Aid Clinic at Villanova Law and says three of those arrested had prior contact with immigration officers.
If they've been targeted by deportation in the past and forcibly removed, the government could try to use those prior deportation orders against them.
Lawyers are fighting for the other nine to be allowed to stay in the U.S. Their attorneys don't want to say which countries their clients are from, saying that information could affect their cases. Immigration attorney Lindsay Sweet represents two of the mushroom workers in detention. In immigration court this week, she says judges offered them two very different options.
One judge at the York County Immigration Court decided that a client could be released on bond.
The other client was told he'd have to wait in York County prison while lawyers tried to have the case dismissed. Sweet says that client has decided to accept removal from the country.
Being subjected to detention away from your family with limited or no contact with your family for weeks and weeks at a time is psychologically trying.
For those who want to fight, Sweet says they hope to have the removals suppressed, saying ICE was trespassing when it entered their workplace. That could take the information that officers discovered about the worker's status during the arrests off the table. ICE declined to comment for this story, and the farm owners haven't responded to interview requests. Caitlin Berry says arresting people without a warrant on private property sets a bad precedent.
From an advocate's perspective, they're creating a police state.
She says this type of immigration enforcement has happened before, just not since President George W. Bush was in office. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Last year, the Kimmel Center in Philadelphia selected three musicians to be part of its jazz residency program. They were given a stipend and resources to compose new music, and this week, they're ready to show what they've done. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
Jawanza Kobe wants to give children what he got as a kid. He was first turned on to jazz by the records his father used to bring home. He remembers in 1963, Oscar Peterson's Night Train played over and over and over on the family record player.
And I wanted to introduce children to jazz music, something that's slowly being diminished in schools, being taken away from school because of arts programs. So I just want to expose the young children to jazz music through a storyline.
Kobe wants to expose kids to jazz by mimicking what Prokofiev did for the symphony in Peter and the Wolf, using a story to introduce kids to the orchestra. But Kobe didn't have a story to tell, so the Kimmel Center hooked him up with playwright Deborah Margolin.
Hey!
Hi! My name's Brother Bird, and I've been flying high over the sky of this city for a long time now.
As it happens, Margolin already had a story in her pocket. When she was raising her two kids, every day they would invent a new part of an ongoing bedtime story about a pack of birds. She says the rambling, free associative story was improvised daily for 8 years.
The kids would argue over plot points. Sometimes when something happened, my son was like, no, that's not what happened. Okay, so we'd make adjustments, yeah. And so everybody had a dramaturgical hand in what happened. If the kids didn't like it, they'd argue about it, and we'd adjust. But the story went on for years.
Kobe asked Margolin to whittle her kids' sprawling story into a tight 40-minute presentation that he could use to illustrate jazz.
We didn't put all the elements of jazz in it, but I just wanted to write from different types of jazz and incorporate that into the story. We do have contemporary jazz, we have traditional jazz, progressive jazz. And even some of the stuff is like smooth jazz.
Kobe created this work through the Kimmel Center's Jazz Residency Program. He was one of three musicians selected to compose new work with the help of the Kimmel. That includes a small stipend and access to the Kimmel's network of artists. Kobe could not have connected with Margolin otherwise. Another artist in the residency is Joanna Pascal. She's a singer who had never before written music. The Kimmel Center hooked her up with a theater director named Ellie Heyman to help her become a writer.
She's more than a director. She's been like my doula, you know, and in the beginning of the process, one of the things she said is, you're not going to write this. You're going to allow it.
Pascal entered the Kimmel Center residency wanting to write a song cycle based on the old Victorian idea of communicating emotions through flowers, wherein each flower represents a particular emotion and those emotions can be mixed into bouquets and given away.
I think what I connected with the flowers was this idea of coded communication. You know, I related to this idea of being able to use flowers when you often don't have the words.
She wrote about the innocence of a dandelion, the seduction of a marigold, and the lily of the valley as a harbinger of hope. Pascal realized that what she had was not just a song cycle, but a piece of theater.
It's actually turned into sort of a one-woman show. It's a deeply personal and intimate exploration of a woman's soul and psyche told through the lens of a flower.
Both Pascal and Kobe used their residencies to write stories through jazz. The third resident, a saxophonist named Max Swan, was not writing a story. He was after a certain sound. In a converted attic studio that doubles as his bedroom in Manayunk, Swan and his four bandmates put the final touches on their debut performance of a dozen new songs. This is also where Swan spends countless hours alone writing new music, and that's when he's not hustling gigs outside, sitting in with other bands, or working his day job at a donut shop. He says his musical career so far has been full but disorganized.
Before the Kimmel would happen, it would be a scramble before every performance. The stuff would turn out great, you know, we had awesome shows. But having something so far in advance that I knew I could commit everything in my being to, from advertising to writing to how do I want people to feel to the theatrical presentation of this music, it's really helped in terms of being cohesive as a band.
This is the sound Swan is going for. It's a fusion of jazz and R&B with electronics and a hint of rock. He says the Kimmel Center residency has given him the structure and focus to step away from the daily hustle and find his groove.
I want to move forward. I want to be ushered into a larger space musically than I'm capable of doing by myself. And the Kimmel has done a remarkable job at starting that process. It's really, the next 6 months are going to be exciting.
All three musicians will perform concerts at the Kimmel Center for the next 3 days. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, today marks the 141st anniversary of the start of the Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia. Held in Fairmount Park, it was the first official World's Fair. Several new innovative products were on public display for the first time, including Alexander Graham Bell's telephone, the Remington typographic machine, Heinz ketchup, and Heyer's root beer. Another innovation presented at the fair was kudzu, introduced as an erosion control plant. Little did they know at the time how that would turn out. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Tomorrow evening, we'll preview a concert series and exhibit on the late composer Julius Eastman. The Curtis Institute alum's work has been receiving renewed interest of late from performers, writers, and audiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.